Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the increasing U.S. vessel interdictions in international waters. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Ian Raubi. Dr. Ian Raubi is our president of Auxilium Worldwide and head of the Ocean Governance efforts at Auxilium Worldwide, amongst other kind of roles that he has. He is a globally recognized expert in maritime law and security with many years of experiences. Ian, it's a great pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation. Brilliant. So we've seen, I think from late 2025 to this early 2026, we've seen some sort of escalation in U.S. Seizure of vessels, especially around the waters of Venezuela and the North Atlantic. What is behind this spate of interdictions?
Well, there are sort of three layers behind it. We have had since really 2022 a massive increase in the amount of vessels that have been sanctioned, oil cargoes that have been sanctioned, and vessel owners that have been sanctioned by either unilateral sanctions, for example, by the United States, regional sanctions by bodies like the EU, or even international sanctions by the United Nations. What we have not seen a whole lot of is actually efforts to enforce those sanctions on the water. And so we've ended up with a phenomenon that has been described as either the shadow fleet, the dark fleet, or the rogue fleet, where literally about almost 1,500 vessels have engaged in practices that are dubious, dangerous, and outside of the norms of well-regulated, well-managed vessel practices. So they are without insurance. They are without safety standards. They're without environmental standards. They haven't had inspections. They haven't had maintenance. So these are, to put it bluntly, rust buckets with poorly maintained operations floating around the ocean with huge amounts of sanctioned oil on board. Mm-hmm. And what has been challenging is that the normal legal mechanism by which we go after ships at sea involves the flag of the vessel. And the biggest phenomenon has been that these vessels have moved from being flagged in Russia, flagged in Iran, flagged in other places that have been experiencing these sanctions, to moving through a variety of different layers. The first layer was to go to other flag states that were perhaps not as popular or not as well managed, then go to flag states that nobody had been watching before. So places, particularly in Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific Islands, saw major booms in vessel registrations. Places like Palau, Cameroon, Gabon, Comoros, Barbados, Jamaica, saw all of a sudden large amounts of vessels moving into their registries almost inexplicably. And the third layer was what has been most prominent for the last year or so, which is those vessels moved from those smaller registries to fake registries. So places that didn't actually allow vessels to fly their flag started seeing a bunch of vessels flying their flag. So Guyana, for example, doesn't offer an open registry. It doesn't allow for you to register your vessel in Guyana. And all of a sudden, 73 vessels were flying the Guyanese flag. Legally. St. Martin, Laos, these different places, we're just seeing a lot of activity, but no true connection between the government and these vessels. And so what has happened is with the different sanctions, the different practices of the shadow fleet, people have grown concerned about the safety of seafarers, the marine environment, and the international security aspects of the fact that these vessels were sanctioned for a reason. So what is the third layer after the sanctions and the shadow fleet is the fact that the United States has been working to control the ingress and egress of oil cargoes from Venezuela. And so these vessels essentially were the low-hanging fruit that got caught in the crosshairs of the U.S. effort to intervene in the sovereign affairs of Venezuela. So it's a a layered issue. And so one point I will make right at the outset, this is not a blockade. I'm a lawyer, and the blockade is a very technical thing. What the U.S. is calling it is a quarantine. And so they're trying to block the movement of oil in and out. And the easiest way to do that is to go after these vessels that are of dubious and often illegal identity. So that are flying the Guyanese flag, which is not authorized, or flying multiple flags, and stop them and impose U.S. sanctions on them. So that's essentially what has led to the seven now tankers that have been boarded and seized either in the Caribbean or in the case of the Marinera up in north near Iceland.
Let me start from the second layer. So that's the shadow fleet and this registry, the flagging. Can you speak more on the legal mechanism? Because it looks like maybe what is the law governing that? And how does flying a flag protect the ship?
There are three types of states in maritime law. There's coastal states, port states, and flag states. The coastal state is anywhere where you have the coastline. So, whether it's Nigeria, Ghana, Benin, Togo, Sierra Leone, all of them have coastlines. And so as a result, they have a right to declare a 12 nautical mile territorial sea, which means that they can have full sovereign control of those 12 nautical miles. Outside of that, though, it starts to get complicated quickly, because from 12 to 24 miles, you can enforce four types of laws: fiscal, immigration, sanitation, and customs laws, just in that 12 to 24 mile band. And then in the 0 to 200 band, you can also enforce fisheries and oil and gas laws. So you have sovereign rights over the living and non-living marine resources in that maritime domain. But the important thing is that outside of 12 nautical miles, everything is considered the area where you have high seas freedoms. Those are what are often called international waters. So outside of 12, the state that matters most is not the coastal state, but the flag state, because every time a vessel is going to engage in an international voyage, it has to be flying a flag. And that flag provides the legal basis for the law that applies on board. So when you see a Nigerian flag vessel 200 miles offshore, or a Ghanaian vessel 500 miles offshore, or a Marshall Islands vessel 500 miles offshore, those are little floating pieces of Nigeria, Ghana, or Marshall Islands going all around the world. And so it means that the maritime space is not actually ungoverned. A lot of people talk about it as ungoverned space. But governing law is the flag state law and international law. And so the flag is extremely important, because it is what provides the responsibility, the legal regime, the clarity of who is responsible for that vessel's activity outside of 12 nautical miles. Now, the port state is the last one, and we don't have to talk much about it, but the port has certain control measures. So you can essentially override the flag state and say, you're coming into our port, you're availing yourself of our jurisdiction. Therefore, for the time that you're here, we're in control more so than the flag state. But we talk about the exclusive flag state regime because that flag state has huge amounts of both responsibility and opportunity. About flagging is enshrined in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea from 1982, longest treaty ever written, and most countries around the world are a party to it. The ones that aren't recognize it as customary international law. Interestingly, neither the United States nor Venezuela are parties to UNCLOS. But the law nevertheless still applies, and there are a couple of key provisions. The most important one is Article 90 and 91 that says that there has to be a genuine link, and those are the words that are used, genuine link between the flag and the vessel. That has been interpreted very loosely over the last several decades. And that loose interpretation means that a genuine link could just mean a contractual relationship with a company that is contracted by the government. So take the Sierra Leone Registry, for example. It's based in Cyprus. It's not even physically on the continent of Africa. It's in Cyprus. And it is legitimate to say that you have a genuine link between your vessel and Sierra Leone, if the vessel has never actually been to Africa at all. It could also never have been to Cyprus at all. It needs to have a contractual relationship with a Cypriot company that then has a contractual relationship with the government of Sierra Leone. So that's how flagging generally works. But what we've seen lately is that there are companies that are setting themselves up claiming to have that relationship actually happen. So, for example, there was a company set up in Beverly Hills, California, that claimed to be offering the St. Martin flag as a jurisdiction where you could register. They also were the same company that was offering the Laos flag. Neither of them were actually allowing that company to sell access to their flag registry. And that was completely fraudulent. And so when you go to board a vessel outside of 12 nautical miles, you have to be very careful what you are using as your theory for getting on board. There are very few things that you can enforce outside of 12 nautical miles. Under Article 110 of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, there are three international crimes: piracy, the slave, and unauthorized broadcasting, or pirate radio. Bit weird, but it comes with the times of 1982. So the other aspect, though, is that if it is your own vessel, so if you're the Nigerian Navy, you're 400 miles offshore, you can board a Nigerian flag vessel, no problem. But if you are trying to interdict for human trafficking, arms trafficking, any kind of resource smuggling, you do not get that right to board that vessel. Drugs are somewhere in between those three international crimes and everything else. Drugs have a separate convention. The 1988 Vienna Drug Convention allows, under Article 17, for a very complicated, convoluted, annoying, really frustrating process. It does allow you to potentially get on board with permission of the flag state. So that leaves us with one other bucket, which is that there are always opportunities to get on board a ship to confirm its registration. So if it is believed to be without nationality, if it is flying two flags, if the flag does not match what its registration suggests, you can board it to confirm that registration. And that is effectively the theory that has allowed for the U.S. to go on all these vessels that have either fraudulent or confused flag registrations. Now, you are allowed under the Article 110 to board an interdict a vessel for an international sanction. So a U.N. sanction allows for you to go on board. That does not apply to unilateral sanctions. So the U.S. enforcing sanctions is not a basis for going on board a ship outside of the United States waters. The possibility is, though, in terms of their legal theory, that they're going on board because of this lack of clear registration. They're determining that it is without nationality, it is stateless, and they are therefore using their jurisdiction over stateless vessels to bring it into the United States, and then can also prosecute for sanctions.
So, I was going to talk, but go on.
No, it's very difficult to explain all of this clearly, succinctly. It's convoluted, and it's a very different world. The law works so differently at sea than it does on land.
I'm going to let you speak a little bit on the sanction regime or the sanction architecture, which you've started, and you know I appreciate that you've shown how convoluted it is. But then again, do we have some sort of hierarchy in terms of how this regime, this architecture works? Because you did cite the international sanction, unilateral sanction, and regional sanction. Is there some hierarchy there?
Absolutely. So UN sanctions are considered akin to a treaty. So if the UN Security Council sanctions someone, it's as if there's a treaty that says you can go and arrest them anywhere, effectively. And so that is the most powerful. Regional, because it crosses a lot of jurisdictions, is pretty powerful because it's a big area. Mm. The unilateral ones, which is really what we're talking about, can only be prosecuted inside of the jurisdiction of the sanctioning state. So the U.S. can't go do sanctions enforcement 200 miles offshore even. And that's where we have a real challenge and problem with the law, in that it isn't clear what the legal theory has been for the U.S. in all of these interdictions. They're calling it sanctions enforcement, but legally, it looks like they're boarding under the right to right of visit to confirm registration, and then using the fact that they're without nationality in order to hail back into the United States, where then they can impose sanctions. But even inside the U.S. law, there has to be a real process that's pursued in order to go after a vessel. So you have to have a particular type of warrant in order to go after it. So it's a weird mix of international and domestic law, and the facts just aren't clear.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute in terms of the legality and how muddy all of this is. But before I go to Africa and all of that, I wanted to talk about, because sometimes we focus on our first episode, looked at maritime security in Africa. It's quite amazing, interesting, that we sometimes focus on crime on the land and not crime on the sea. But it looks like the crime on the sea, or activities on the sea, the transportation is quite massive. Do you want to speak briefly on that before we go?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's important to remember a couple of things. Number one, 70% of the earth is covered in water. And we are very terrestrially focused because we all live on land. So 100% of people live on land, but 70% of the earth is covered in water, which means we are paying much more attention to 30% of the earth than the other 70%. And as a result, we typically don't know what's going on. We don't watch it. We don't pay attention to it. We don't respect it as much. And yet 20% of all dietary protein intake around the world of all human beings comes from fish on average. 90% of world trade happens by sea. That means that all of our goods, from clothes to medicine to telecommunications equipment to technology to food, 90% of it has been on a boat. And so no matter where you are, whether you're on the coast or in a landlocked or doubly landlocked state, you are looking at the reality that without maritime commerce, there isn't most of what's available there. In other words, we say no shipping, no shopping. Mm. And so that access to the sea is absolutely vital for access to international trade. And so in the Gulf of Guinea, in Africa as a whole, there's been a huge amount of innovation applied to maritime security cooperation, because two phenomena, the phenomena of piracy and the phenomena of illegal fishing, have grossly undercut and undermined the national economies, not only of the coastal states, but even of the land-linked states, as they often call them. So Niger, for example, provides a marine patrol aircraft to Zone E, the cooperative block involving Nigeria, Benin, and Togo as well, because their access to the sea is as important as the coastal states. So it's a really important dynamic to recognize that our life on land is entirely dependent on what's happening at sea. But because we don't pay attention to it, we don't think about it, we don't even respect the fact that this very interaction is made possible by submarine cables the size of a garden hose just sitting on the ocean floor. And so that internet telecommunications access is entirely dependent on the sea now. 99% of all telephonic and internet activity goes through submarine cables. So our need for protecting the maritime domain is huge, but the ones that understand the wealth in it, the ones that understand the value of it, the ones that understand the opportunities for getting wealth out of it the best are all criminals. And so that maritime crime aspect has been growing in recent years as we've seen success in criminal enterprise at sea, unmet, unchecked, and sometimes with great profit involved. And so maritime crime is a huge, huge problem in Africa. Is surrounded by water. And so the maritime space of Africa has enormous amounts of wealth in it. And its access to the global market is through that maritime space. And so criminals have glommed onto that. Unfortunately, it's a lot of work to build up the national level capacity and the regional cooperative capacity to push back against it. But there's amazing work that's been done. The Yaounde architecture for maritime security has been a huge, not only impact on the region, but also influence to other parts of the world as well. And certain pockets of cooperation are really admirable, but there's always more work to be done. No country on earth, no region on earth thinks that it solves maritime security because, frankly, the vastness of the maritime domain, the opportunities for innovation and the amount of wealth that's both in it and moving on it is so extreme that we're always going to be behind the ball on catching up with the criminals. And so we need to see who's leading, who's following, but we've got to do a lot more work to get to the point of being the lead.
I'm glad you mentioned that the back to Africa, the Gulf of Guinea, and then the kind of like notorious for piracy. Looking at the Niger Delta, oil theft and all of that. Then look at Gulf of Somalia with terrorist activities, even Western and Southern Africa as well. We've seen, but we've also seen interdictions even in recent times in these places. We've seen. I think there was as 2025, there's a French intervention season, I think 10 tons of cocaine of West Africa. You mentioned fishing as well. I think fishing, it's illegal fishing is like a larger whatever in those places. So, but you mentioned pockets of collaborations that have been going on in there. So we've had some kind of exercises between US fleets, Navy and Navy. Do you want to speak on the governance? I know you mentioned the governance of the sea in these gulfs in Africa and the motivation behind these governance, how effective they are.
So I think that's a great question. And I think, to me, governance is how we solve the problem of disorder in the maritime space. And so that includes a mix of institutions, policy, law, and activity. And so, what a lot of the attention has been on in Africa over the last 13 years, since about 2012, 2013, has been establishing the institutions of governance in the Gulf of Guinea in particular, where you have a framework and an architecture for security cooperation that then is working on the principle of subsidiarity. In other words, the sovereign states are still the ones that are actually at the top, even though at the pyramid, they look like they're at the bottom. They're the ones that have the ultimate decision, the rights, the laws. It's their sovereignty that is fundamentally at stake. And so governance has to be a national level phenomenon that is at the same time cooperative in a regional and even continent-wide context. So governance is about figuring out what the most effective, efficient, and practical way of addressing the threats you have actually are. And so in the maritime space, that means being responsive to the reality. And as you mentioned, the focus was so extreme on piracy from about 2010, 11, all the way through until 2021 is when we really saw a drastic drop. You know, in 2020, 95% of all seafarers abducted at sea worldwide were taken in the Gulf of Guinea. It was the hotspot. But a mix of things changed that dynamic. Part of it was, going to points of governance, passing of laws. And so SPOMO in Nigeria, the Suppression of Piracy and Other Maritime Offenses Act, finally made it illegal under domestic law in Nigeria to engage in piracy. It wasn't illegal before that. And so go back to 2016, you had a very famous case of the Maximus that was boarded by two vessels about 60 miles off the coast of Cote d'Ivoire. It was sailed back through the Gulf, so it went across the waters of Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigeria, and into the exclusive economic zone of Sao Tome. And in the process, you had a lot of different navies chasing it, a lot of good cooperation. Nigerian Navy catches up to it and ultimately is the one to arrest it, bring it back to Nigeria. Famous piracy case on the water, not a piracy case in the courts because there is no piracy law. So a really interesting mismatch. So they had to charge it with, weapons violations and petroleum violations and other things. So having an actual law that makes these maritime crimes, the things that have been happening on the water illegal, meant that you could prosecute. And so the law is one part, the prosecution is the other. And suddenly, if the risk reward calculus changes so that your chance of success in getting some money out of a piracy incident is almost the same as your chance of ending up in jail for the rest of your life, your decision,
he
might kind of think twice. And so, you know, that's a major function of governance that has changed. The other is investments and procurement. So Falcon Eye, Deep Blue in Nigeria, both had a huge impact on monitoring the maritime space to allow for transparency and visibility of the maritime domain so that activity could go in and you know, the Nigerian Navy could go and arrest things closer to real time. Persistence. I mean, this cooperative dynamic over time started to actually yield results, and the presence of naval assets out on the water, both from the region and from other states, helps to deter. You're unlikely to commit a crime when you know that law enforcement is watching. And so that makes a big, big difference. And so what we've seen is a drastic reduction in piracy, huge reduction in piracy, but not the same reduction in illegal fishing. And we've seen at the same time an increase in drug trafficking. And so, you know, one of the challenges is if you build capacity in one area of maritime crime to the detriment of all the others, you end up just playing whack-a-mole and moving from one illegal activity to the other. Criminals don't care, right? They're not determined to be pirates. They're determined to make money.
Make money, yeah. So
about profit. And so if it's unprofitable to engage in piracy, but profitable instead to engage in drug trafficking or illegal fishing, they'll just move into the others. And so the whole point is the governance has to be comprehensive and it has to be responsive to the operating environment. And so I often talk about what I call the law enforcement cycle, and it starts with the law. You need the law to actually say what should and shouldn't be happening out on the water. Then monitor and surveil that maritime space so you can see what is actually going on. Then you analyze to determine if what is happening is undesirable, illegal, actionable, achievable, and worth doing. And once you realize that something is out of place, you want to do something about it, you're allowed to do something about it, you physically can do something about it, it's worth doing something about it, then you plan an operation, you execute that operation, you try to collect evidence in the process, hand it over to land-based authorities in a way that they can actually arrest people and put them through a legal process. That legal finish is absolutely critical, again, for changing that risk-reward calculus. And so ultimately, you want a prosecution, adjudication, and some kind of penalization so that that penalty is significant enough that they don't want to do it. And this is where we talk about the issue of harmonization, right? So harmonization is sometimes a cause for some angst because it sounds like it's undermining sovereignty. But it's not about undermining sovereignty. It's about making sure that you're matching up your sovereign rights to do whatever you want with your sovereign responsibilities to do what's best for your people. And that responsibility piece is interesting because if you can set your penalties lower than everybody else, but what's that going to do? It's going to make you a magnet for crime. And so the whole point of harmonization is ensuring not that everything looks the same, but that you have comparable, similar outputs of the rule of law across a whole region so that nobody is that magnet. And that's what the penalization piece is really important on.
Yeah, speaking of governance, that's still staying in Africa, but I'll use them. I think it was yesterday we've seen where, I think it was the French. With sweet intelligence from the Brits.
But
I want to link that to Africa and then look at how, especially in the Gulf of Somalia, we've seen where there's been some, like Ivrali said, you need cooperation, but we've seen some sort of competition, whether be it Egypt, we've seen Ethiopia trying to form a deal with Somaliland and, you know, trade assets, trade routes. And how does all of this complicate the governance of this maritime space?
I mean, so the question is, what's your goal? The good thing about criminals is they all have a very clear understanding of what their goal is. And so they can stay laser focused on it and they can be creative, adaptable, agile. They, something gets in their way, they find a way around it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you have politics, when you have personalities, when you have national identity, when you have history, you have all these other things involved in the decision making, it's not as clear what the goal is. So is the goal to have a very safe, secure, stable, and prosperous maritime domain across all of Africa? Or is it to do a better job than your neighbor? Or is it to get that territory or let them suffer a little bit so that you can get in there? And so when you see competition entering the fold, it undermines security, it undermines safety, it undermines everybody's not only sovereignty, but prosperity. And so the problem with some of the competitive dynamics is that people think that somebody else being unsafe, somebody else being insecure, somebody else having diminished sovereignty, somebody else having diminished prosperity benefits them. Because in comparison, they look better for a time. What they don't recognize is that it undermines everybody. And so I go back to a discussion I remember from maybe like 2010 involving the company security officers of all the shipping lines that were talking about security in the piracy context off of Somalia. And they said, we are probably the world's most competitive industry. And when you get to the tanker sector, you have the two most competitive industries, oil and gas and shipping, kind of bumping heads against each other. We can compete on everything except for security, because the moment that security becomes an issue, we all end up losing. Yes, everybody gets diminished. And so that's where, unfortunately, a lack of understanding of the maritime domain, a lack of appreciation for the wealth in the maritime domain, and a lack of appreciation for the cooperative dynamic of the maritime domain. It's something that is shared by all of us. It is what connects us. Literally, what is the causeway between Africa and every other continent is the water. And so the small-mindedness of being competitive on maritime security always undermines everybody.
So you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the layers, you mentioned the last layer was the oil cargo. Stuff. So what we've seen also another dimension, which is like the geopolitical kind of like competition between the US and maybe China and Russia and stuff like that. Even the Venezuela stuff is somewhat kind of linked to the US looking at maybe Venezuela as being some kind of a haven or some kind of conduit where these other people are using to do that. So if we bring that into play and look at how in recent times, though we've seen where exercises have been done in the Gulf of Guinea, the US fleet or Ban Game Express and all this other kind of stuff. Yep. We've also seen Chinese vessels or fleets also having some kind of vessel. Well, how do you think this kind of geopolitical competition is influencing, you know, maritime security?
Hugely. And unfortunately, I would say that for a while, it looked like there was perhaps more benevolence in some states than others. But at this point, you have to question what the motivations of any partner state may be, whether it's the EU, the US, China, Russia, Iran, Turkey, anybody that is involving itself in the maritime domain in Africa. What's the goal? And, you know, there are some areas where it is of mutual benefit for everybody to be more safe, secure, stable, and prosperous. That is true. But sometimes those states are coming in with much more self-interest. Sometimes regionally, they're coming in with self-interest. And so every sovereign state has to do an assessment for itself of what its own risk-reward calculus is in engaging in partnership and engaging in things. Now, I spent a lot of my career working for the U.S. government in Africa. I was with Department of Defense, and we had a very clear goal. We wanted to be the most ardent, honest defenders of sovereignty in Africa of any partner. That was the goal. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the goal today. And so, unfortunately, it changes how the behavior is. So my approach to supporting maritime security in Africa was to engage in what I called Africa to Africa capacity building. I didn't want to be the expert on the stage. I wanted to highlight the African experts who were going to be in Africa for the rest of their lives, not just me for a week. And so, you know, the point of what we tried to do was create relationships between neighboring states, between regions, and say, listen, you guys have all the resources you need. Here are some people that you might want to look at to turn to. Don't come, you don't have to come to us. The expertise is here, the ingenuity is here, the understanding of the problem is here. So the understanding of the solution is also here. And that's where our focus was, so that it could be a sustainable approach. Now, I think a lot of the international affairs are being conducted through pure money and much more aggressive action. And I think, unfortunately, that doesn't lead to sustainable security in the long term. And so I think African states have a huge choice to make. But my point to all of them always was, as a block, you are stronger than almost everyone else. The demographics are in Africa. The wealth is actually in Africa. The question is how to leverage it in a way that makes it so that through good governance, through transparent governance, and through harnessing that wealth in a way that keeps the wealth, not just the money, but the wealth inside of Africa is critically important. And part of wealth is understanding how to harness it, keeping that expertise, that knowledge, that capacity to turn raw materials into refined products is absolutely critical.
Yeah, I'm glad. Let's finish up on that note. I'm glad you mentioned that. And then, you know, that ties into the current book that I'm working on. I've been working on this issue, question of democracy, and also looking at how democracy has been receding in civilized, mature democracies in America, even everywhere. And you look at how Africa itself, where that creates an opportunity for Africa to start looking inwards, to create a system that works for it and all of that. And I'm glad you mentioned that. But again, we're looking at how our world seems to be kind of like diffuse in terms of no power. So we see how Russia invaded Ukraine. And the West, America, is Trump invaded Venezuela and talk of invading Greenland. And it looks like there's some kind of like security vacuum. And the United Nations seems to be at its, I'll say, weakest. So in the light of all of this, dynamics and what you've really said about Africa, how does Africa project itself in protecting its interest? And I'm glad you mentioned about self-interest, which I think, I don't think there's anything wrong. I don't think there's any altruistic intervention. People always have their own strategic interests. But how does Africa then match his own interests with, how do we harmonize, if I use the word harmonize, this interest? Yeah. So I'm guessing, how does Africa leverage all of this?
So I think, you know, one of the things that has been really depressing in recent times is to watch all these theories of democracy kind of, as you say, recede. One of the big ones was the democratic peace theory, right? That two democracies are unlikely to ever attack each other. And unfortunately, we've seen this week the development of what seems to be an effort to compete with the United Nations through the Board of Peace, which is of dubious origin in that a lot of the initial invitees are not those best known for peace, but those best known for violating Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. Which is the prohibition on the use of force between states. And in other words, the enshrinement, the legal enshrinement of the notion of peace. Furthermore, if you look at the list of states that have already joined the board, democracy is clearly not one of the criteria or considerations. And so this sort of receding interest in democracy and democratization is of concern, because what you end up with is leaders who hold on to power without being responsive in any way to the people over whom they wield that power. And in Africa, you have the youngest population in the world. You have an enormous youth population. The demographics are, as I said, are hugely pointing towards Africa being the world's future. And you have the oldest leaders. and so not to criticize them, there's incredible knowledge and potential experience in older leaders, but the ones that have been in power for decades and who are holding on to that power are perhaps not as responsive as others. And so I think the youth voice in Africa has to be heard, has to be much more clearly provided opportunities for expression, constructive expression, that then allows for some kind of change. Now, how that actually works, it's not for me to say, but this very podcast is one of those kinds of opportunities to vocalize the governance principles that are needed. And so, you know, if you look at how international affairs work, states alone, unless they are the very, very big, very, very powerful, very, very wealthy, have a hard time convincing everyone else to meet their own way. But blocks of states together with a unified voice, no matter how small they are, have incredible amounts of power. And so Africa as a block, I think 54 countries is so potentially potent in determining the future of world affairs if it works together. And so I think this is where, in terms of youth engagement, it can't just be at the national level. It's got to be at the regional level and the continent-wide level, where a unified voice could change the face of global affairs. Mm. And I think that would be the most democratic approach, whether it's involving countries that are themselves democratic or not. If there's a means for the youth to actually speak up in Africa, that will change things. But it is not easy. I don't want to sell sunshine. Things are very difficult, and they're not heading in a way that points towards a peaceful future, a stable future, a calm future, and certainly not a prosperous future for all. But I think that you know, ingenuity and determination can lead. I've never seen a level of entrepreneurial spirit and ingenuity as I have in Africa. And I think that if that were all harnessed towards good, legal, productive governance approaches, then there would be so much opportunity to do something different and not follow the models that clearly aren't working elsewhere, but to do something that is truly different, that is responsive to the needs and interests of the continent. And that's where I see things moving.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And speaking of, thank you for your kind words towards the podcast, which I think is very important, creating alternatives. And I've also, in my last book, I talk about the pugnancy of the youth, of the African youth, in transforming the continent. And I've also taken that further in terms of, like, we're organizing some sort of youth leadership national dialogue in Abuja next month. And I've had people from elsewhere in Africa, youth, calling and say, we need this kind of stuff. And exactly. I say, we need to provide a platform for them to be able to effect the change. So I agree with you 100% that there's some sort of hope with that demographic and how they can shape, you know.
And the worst thing, and this is my biggest fear, my biggest concern, hope is incredibly powerful. But when it gets crushed, it is incredibly difficult to resuscitate. Yeah. And so how do you make sure that you're harnessing hope in a way that doesn't line it up for failure and it doesn't line it up to be crushed, which often ends up leading to a backlash? Because those who are most hopeful, who have that hope crushed, tend to be the most jaded, most cynical, and often can be quite destructive in response. And so how do we make sure that hope is nurtured in a way that points towards action that makes a difference without running so headlong into the barriers that have been put up in order to safeguard the system as it is. So I think that's a real challenge.
Yeah, it's something to think about. And then it's not just hope, it's also action. And I agree with you 100%. And just to finish on that note, we saw in Madagascar what happened. Yeah. The youth having stuff, and that quickly became hijacked by the military. And so I understand your concern, which is very legitimate. But anyways, thank you very much, Ian. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. And I'll be in touch shortly.
I look forward to continuing the conversation.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Ian Rabi, for his rich insight into the very rich conversation on U.S. interdiction in international waters and similar issues in Africa, across the Gulf of Guinea, Gulf of Somalia, and across waters in South and West Africa. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.